My cat, Freddy, loves to be brushed and cuddled. But stirring up his cat allergens meant sneezing and itchy eyes.
Achoo!
Then I found Purina One Live Clear. It's cat food that reduced the major allergen and my suffering in as little as 21 days. Now, we feel closer than ever. If you have issues with cat allergens, you really need to try Purina One Live Clear.
Try new Purina One Live Clear today. Purina One, a difference from day one.
We both were at a communal liturgy that people from different faiths were welcomed to. It was a Catholic mass, but it was a pretty communal liturgy at St. Ignatius Parish, which is right on the edge of Boston College's campus. So even though I had graduated, I still went to that liturgy a bit and saw Claire afterwards. And she said, oh, you know, I'm having a birthday party this weekend. It's nice to see you. You should come out to this.
I had invited a few folks out for my birthday celebration at a bar. It's a very low-key thing. And it invited Ben, and he didn't show up. But I got a text message from him 2 days later saying, I'm at the bar. I just realized I'm 2 days late. Can I buy you a drink?
And it was funny because neither one of us was confident that it was a date or that the other understood it as a date. But the question had come up for both of us. I'm Ben Holman. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I currently work as an assistant professor of religious and theological studies at Salve Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island.
And I'm Claire Cohen, and I was raised Eastern Orthodox and am still practicing. And I am also a professor in religious studies at Salve University.
Our 8-year wedding anniversary will be this November 4th. We got married 2 years and a day after we started dating. So we've been together 9.5 years, but married 7.5.
And we have 2 kids, Ivan and Evelyn.
Oh, the Lord is good to me, and so I thank the Lord.
How very full of grace and over sweat.
D. Blessed
are
thou. Ivan is my son from my first marriage, and so Ivan was baptized Orthodox and has been raised in the Orthodox Church. But as a family, we go back and forth.
Evelyn was born in the context of this marriage. We've raised her really in both traditions. Because we don't have a systematic, large-scale solution to this at the level of the organized church, it's left to individual consciences and individual communities to try to figure out what is the right thing to do for us in this situation.
We have 2 Easters. So we start Lent on the Catholic schedule, and we have Catholic Easter, and then we go back to fasting, Orthodox style, and we have Easter 2.0, as we like to call it. And when you have an Easter 2.0, the extra nice thing is that all of the Easter candy is half off. And the kids love it because they get 2 Easter baskets.
For Evelyn, she's 4, so I think she's not always needing an explanation for why she gets to have more candy. Evelyn is aware that we attend 2 different communities, and we work really hard not to say mommy's church and daddy's church.
Ivan's also very looped into both communities. He really thrives in community, and we've worked really hard to sort of build those relationships in each community.
One of the things I love about Easter is we get to sing the Gloria again and do all these things and say Alleluia. And there's a lot of very thoughtful things about the way we celebrate the liturgy and the way the liturgical calendar leads us to live into the joy of Easter, that when you have to try to undo that afterward, it's bizarre.
I think that any movement towards full communion is a good thing. The fact that Ben is not invited to take communion when we're in the Orthodox Church can be a painful experience. Imagine, you know, inviting a group of friends over to dinner and then one friend just has to watch you all eat. It's very inhospitable, is how it feels. Yes, we'll lose the 50% off candy, but we'll be one step closer to how it should be, united in Christ.
I feel the same way, especially in 2025. Separation between Christian churches just makes less and less sense. We lifted the mutual anathemas between the churches in the middle of the 20th century. So I would really like to see a broader Christian push towards a common date, not just between Catholic and Orthodox, but between all Christian churches.
This year, Ben and Claire's family will celebrate Easter on the same date, because Easter in the Orthodox and Catholic churches falls on April 20th. This happens every few years, because the churches follow different calendars, but this year's alignment is particularly important. Why? Because 2025 marks the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. 2025 is also a Catholic Jubilee year, so there's been a particularly strong push from Pope Francis and Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, the leader of many Orthodox churches, to finally settle on a common way to calculate Easter.
The date of Easter is the most important feast and day of the year for Christians. All Christians. It's wrong that we're not celebrating Easter together.
It's a widely shared goal among many Christians, but there's been very little progress.
The issues are complex, as you may have guessed. They are astronomical, literally. They relate to the sun and the moon, but they're also deeply pastoral.
And the debate that's going on today is rooted in the very council we're commemorating this year, the Council of Nicaea.
There were disagreements about when Easter should be celebrated, and it must have been disagreements to the point in which the intensity of such led Constantine to intervene.
In this special deep dive episode of Inside the Vatican, we look back at the Council of Nicaea and why it's still important today.
The Nicene Creed is born not out of just a nice idea that we should all be able to say some good things together, but from a real need to show that Christians could articulate their faith coherently but simply, and could do that universally.
We'll hear from Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant scholars about the state of ecumenism today.
Perhaps there are gifts of the Holy Spirit that we would not have received had it not been for some of the divisions in the course of history.
And with a better understanding of Nicaea, we'll revisit the debate over a common date for Easter and the questions it raises about how we carry forward the common faith expressed by the first ecumenical council.
We should be aiming not to what Nicaea did, but what Nicaea was about, which was about bringing unity to the church. If we're not working for unity today, we're actually betraying Nicaea.
I'm Colleen Dully. This is Inside the Vatican.
My name is Aristotle Papanikolaou. I am a professor of theology, but I also hold the Archbishop Demetrius Chair in Orthodox Theology and Culture, and I'm also the co-founding director of the Orthodox Christian Studies Center, all at Fordham University. People call me Telly, because in Greek, Aristotle is Aristoteli, and famous Tellys are Tellys of Alis, not well known to the younger audience here. But then there's Telly Monster.
Indeed. I know that one. I have a 2-year-old.
Right. Or television, you know, for the Brits.
I asked Telly to give me a rundown of the Council of Nicaea.
Sure. Let me go back to the time of Jesus and promise to be brief.
It's a big ask.
As I make my way up to the 4th century, 325, I would ask the listeners to really consider that. I mean, it's 325 years from the time of Jesus to the Council of Nicaea. In general, after Jesus ascended, the early Christian followers did make use of councils. In Acts 15, there was a disagreement.
A reading from the Acts of the Apostles.
While Paul and Barnabas were in Antioch of Syria, some men from Judea arrived and began to teach the believers.
From Judea were instructing the brothers.
The brethren, quote, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved.
Paul and Barnabas disagreed with them, arguing vehemently. Finally, the church decided to send Paul and Barnabas to Jerusalem, accompanied by some local believers, to talk to the apostles and elders about this question.
And they held a council in Jerusalem and sort of decided matters that, in fact, converts did not have to be circumcised. And it's very interesting because in the Orthodox world, and I'm sure in the Catholic world, there are icons of Peter and Paul hugging each other, kind of trying to show that, yeah, we know that they fought, but sort of they reconciled. But it is an icon of what councils are, to some extent, meant to do.
So under the Roman Empire, up to the early 4th century, the church was small, but it did have organizational structures, especially in the urban centers. They convened small local councils to solve problems. So the conciliar kind of model is there from the very beginning of the church. And there was really no way for the church up to the 4th century to organize globally. There was no pope to really be able to call kind of a global conference. Yes, there was a Bishop of Rome, but at that time, the Bishop of Rome's powers were nowhere nearly recognized the way they are now today, not even close. But they did have local councils.
For those first three centuries, Christians in the Roman Empire were pretty much constantly under threat. Remember, the reason Jesus was killed was that he was seen as a threat to the empire, and Christianity remained a target of persecution in many places. Until Constantine.
So Constantine, Roman emperor, decides to convert. And that's a really big deal.
That conversion happens in 312. And the next year, Constantine legalizes Christianity.
And what he soon recognized was that Christians were actually debating certain kinds of issues. And now that he is the emperor and he's giving some privileges to the Christian churches, those debates are actually starting to affect the Roman Empire, sort of the administration of it, sort of the unity of it, the cohesion of it. And he decides to call a council in a place called Nicaea, which is a suburb of Constantinople, present-day Istanbul. And it really becomes the first global gathering of Christian bishops within the Roman Empire.
Over 300 bishops, to be precise. Most of them were from the East, and they gathered in 325 AD from May through July.
So it is quite an amazing event in some sense, and it only could have been done because Constantine became the emperor. So it is what's called an imperial council. Even though it is a church council, it really is an imperial council.
The stakes are high for Constantine. If the emperor's religious community can't agree on some fundamental things, what does that say about the emperor's decision to follow this religion? And what risks might church divisions bring for the unity of the empire once Christianity becomes more popular?
So the council itself is structured in such a way, or brought together, to handle practical issue and a theological issue. The date of Easter and debates about the divinity of Jesus Christ, which had been under discussion in various local churches, and there are manuscripts to show this, prior to Constantine, but everything kind of came to a head in the 4th century.
While the council's rulings on Arianism, the Nicene Creed, and calculating a common date for Easter often take center stage, and they're our focus here, there's a lot more to this story that deserves at least a passing mention. It was at Nicaea that the bishops established some of the first precepts of canon law, and they ended a schism that had divided the Egyptian church. So let's get into how Nicaea resolved controversies over setting a common date for Easter. Basically, there were a lot of different regional formulas for calculating when Easter should fall. At Nicaea, they agreed on just one. Easter would be the Sunday after the first full moon following the spring equinox. And this was all based on what we now know were faulty approximations of both the equinox and when the full moon would be. Still, this was a unifying answer. Then there was the debate about the divinity of Jesus. That was a little more complicated.
You know, there were a range of opinions, basically, for 325 years, anywhere from Jesus is a great guy and great moral figure to the theological conclusion that Jesus is full God, fully divine and fully human. The key players of this debate were someone named Arius, but he had a bunch of followers, and there were kind of different versions of what I'm going to describe as Arius's position, sort of nuanced versions of it. And one of the other key players, both around the time of the council and afterwards, is a guy named Athanasius of Alexandria. And so, to some extent, one can get a really good sense of what went down at the council by kind of looking at the writings that preserve these debates between Athanasius in particular and the various kinds of people who supported one version or another of what's called the Arian position.
The Arian controversy, the most important crisis that the church has faced in all of its history.
Denied the divinity of Jesus Christ.
Arius believed that Jesus was the greatest creature to ever live,
but he was nevertheless a created being.
Jesus was actually created by the Father, and therefore didn't always exist.
There was, after all, only one God. Soon, the entire church was engaged in this debate.
Arius says that Jesus cannot be God.
So let's break it down. We'll start with Arius.
Arius and his followers were like, look, Jesus is the Christ, the Savior. Jesus is divine in some way. Jesus is not just an ordinary angel or an intermediary figure, right? It was pretty common to think that even if there is a one God, that there are kind of intermediary divinities. It was pretty much a default setting in the pre-modern world, especially a few centuries after Jesus. So there are a lot of nuances to that debate, like how is Jesus divine? In what way is he sort of like one of those intermediary divinities? Is he sort of, you know, half, you know, kind of semi-divine, that kind of stuff. But Arius just wasn't ready to kind of affirm what the council did, which is the full divinity. And he had good reasons, quite honestly. He didn't want to affirm the full divinity because he said, look, if we affirm the full divinity, then we're back to polytheism and we're no better than the pagans, right? I mean, Jesus believed in the one God, the Father. And in many ways for Arius and his followers, there was a great worry, right? That somehow to believe that Jesus is fully divine is somehow not to affirm belief in the one God, right? Monotheism. He's trying to affirm the fact that for our salvation, Jesus must be divine in some way because only God can save, only divinity can save. But he can't go all the way to full divinity because that would mean, in his eyes, that we're betraying belief in the one God. And that for him, it would be betraying what he thought to be the message of Jesus himself. But Athanasius comes along and he says that's not good enough.
The story of Athanasius is one of courage.
He was an ardent anti-Arian.
Jesus Christ was not simply of similar substance to the Father.
Jesus was not a created being. He was God.
Same substance, essence as the Father.
He basically says, look, Arius, we agree Jesus is the Christ. We agree that that means that Jesus brings salvation. We agree that to bring salvation, Jesus must be divine in some way. But what you're getting wrong, Arius and followers, is this. Jesus must be fully divine in order to save us because only full divinity is possible to save us. Nothing less than full divinity is able to save us. And one last thing. If Arius, in fact, was concerned about, oh no, what's going to happen to monotheism, Athanasius's response was kind of like this. I'm paraphrasing, but if your idea of monotheism is such that God is so distant that God needs intermediaries to communicate with not God, then you need to rethink what it means for God to be one. Then you need to rethink what it means for God to be simple. Because that kind of God that can't communicate with us, it can't be in full union with us, that doesn't offer God's life for us, is a God that doesn't really do us any good.
And this is where the Council of Nicaea introduced a key concept that shaped Christianity as we know it today. The word homoousios.
Homoousios.
Homoousios.
Now, that's a mouthful, but let me break it down. Homo means same, and ousia means substance or essence. So it means that Jesus is of the same substance as God the Father. You might recognize this formulation from the Nicene Creed that we say at Mass on Sundays and on feast days. Remember struggling to say consubstantial when the Mass translation changed back in 2010, at least in the US? We used to say one in being, but in English, consubstantial simply means of the same substance.
I believe in one Lord Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son of God, born of the Father before all ages. God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, consubstantial with the Father.
This articulation was groundbreaking. It declared that Jesus and God are fully united, not one being superior to the other, just a perfect connection between two individual persons or entities. This was a profound and paradoxical articulation of the faith that was believed across the empire by ordinary Christians.
Athanasius and the council threw into the thought world of the West a very radical statement, a very radical kind of way of seeing God. It threw into the conversation this idea that whatever the transcendent is, whatever the infinite is, whatever God is, we have to think it
in and through its unity with the material world. And for that time, I don't think people really appreciate how radical of a position that is.
While the Council of Nicaea formalized this idea, it didn't begin there. Its roots go back much earlier, to the first Christian communities, and even to Jesus' time. These Christians were already grappling with the idea that God, while transcendent, could also be deeply connected to humanity, present in our world. After all, that was their experience of Jesus and the preaching of the apostles.
That idea that got thrown into the thought world happened because of the early Christians naming Christ as the Messiah. So they named him the Messiah, and that just started a train of thinking that culminated in this very, very provocative and radical idea that this transcendent God somehow loves us so much that God is willing to kind of be in the muck of our corruptibility, corporeality, to somehow bring us, to make us aware freely of our desire to be in union with God. I mean, that is such a radical idea.
And this wasn't just a radical idea for our Christian forebears. Telly believes that revisiting Nicaea's formulation of this early Christian conviction could profoundly impact how Christians today express the faith. He's convinced that it could help us course correct what he sees as a deep misunderstanding of our core beliefs.
People today have a caricature of Christianity, and Christians are to blame for this, quite honestly, that it's about rules, either to get to heaven or, you know, if you don't follow the rules, you go to hell. I've been teaching students for 25 years. That's pretty much even across the millennials and the Gen Zers. That is their caricature of religion, all of it. And I think that they would be surprised to realize that Christianity really isn't about rules. Of course, we have rules, but what is the point of the rules? Christianity really is about the possibility for us today, now, here, to experience God, to experience divinity, and in doing so, to really be experiencing God as love. And that idea was thrown into the world, into the Western world, by the Council of Nicaea.
The Council of Nicaea gave the Christian world a radical gift, the belief that God, the creator of the universe, is fully present in human flesh. It was a vision of unity, not just between heaven and earth, but among Christians too. But unity may have been easier to proclaim than to preserve. After the break, the long unraveling, schism, calendar reform, geopolitics, and the growing push to bring Christians back together for our most important feast. Stay with us.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile, with a message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan, equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Nicaea was a moment of great unification for the Christian church, establishing shared doctrine and affirming Jesus' full divinity. But ultimately, as in any community, debates and disagreements continued over the centuries. And without an emperor like Constantine to enforce unity, the church would go on to experience more painful divisions. Some were resolved, while others persist to this day. Like the Great Schism of 1054. This was when the Christian church split into what are still known as the Eastern and Western or Latin churches. The reasons for it were complex, and we can't get to all of them here. But like at the time of Nicaea, there were political, cultural, and linguistic divisions at play, as well as theological ones. The biggest concerned the role of the Pope and the question of whether the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, as the Western churches adopted in their creed, or if the Spirit only proceeds from the Father, as the Eastern churches believed. About 500 years after that schism came the East-West split over the date of Easter. As the Julian calendar, which had been used since 45 BC, grew increasingly out of sync with the actual movements of the sun, Pope Gregory XIII reformed the calendar, introducing the Gregorian calendar, the one we use today. But the question arose, if the Council of Nicaea's method of calculating Easter depended on the Julian calendar, was it a betrayal of Nicaea to shift that method over to the Gregorian calendar? The Eastern churches decided that it was, while the Western one, ruled by the Pope who had reformed the calendar, adopted the new calculation. And because the church held so much political power, Western society followed suit, even in regions where the new Protestant Reformation was gaining steam. That's how we end up with Protestants and Catholics generally celebrating Easter on the same day, while the Orthodox churches often celebrate it later, often several weeks later, and in rare cases, more than a month later.
The Protestant Reformation is certainly the most important political and theological and religious change in Christianity, certainly since Eastern Orthodox Christianity split off. Martin Luther was the most important figure in initiating the Protestant Reformation.
Roman Catholic priest and monk, and a college professor in Wittenberg.
He composed a document called the 95 Theses, which outlined in detail his complaints against the Catholic Church.
He took on the Roman Curia, he took on the Pope, he took on the Emperor.
It would take another 500 years after the Reformation for the East-West division over Easter to crack. Following the devastation of the First World War, Ecumenical Patriarch Germanus V issued an unprecedented letter to all churches of Christ, wherever they may be, calling for them to create a League of Churches, a Christian counterpart to the newly founded League of Nations. His vision wouldn't be realized until after the even more destructive Second World War. Just a few years after that war ended, in 1948, Christians from various groups came together to establish the World Council of Churches, a first-of-its-kind group devoted to ecumenical dialogue. They operated under what came to be known as the Lund Principle.
There was a faith and order statement back in 1952 called the Lund Principle, which suggested that Christian churches should do all things together except where deep differences require that we act separately. So what can we actually do together? Certainly celebrating our major feasts at the same time would be very significant. It's kind of a public reminder of our separation when we can't do that.
This is Archbishop Donald Bolin, the Catholic Archbishop of Regina, Saskatchewan in Canada. For 12 years, he's been a member of the Vatican's Department for Promoting Christian Unity, which works to improve dialogue and strengthen ties between the Catholic Church and other Christian denominations.
At present, I'm the co-chair of the International Anglican Roman Catholic Commission for Unity and Mission, which goes by the acronym IARCM, and had served on the International Evangelical Dialogue and certainly over the years as a staff member with Methodist Catholic Dialogue and the Anglican Roman Catholic Dialogue. So deeply committed to the ecumenical enterprise.
Ecumenical dialogue didn't come as naturally to Catholics as it did to the churches that joined the World Council of Churches, especially before Vatican II. To this day, the Roman Catholic Church doesn't belong to the World Council, although it's worked with them in other ways since 1965, just after Vatican II.
We moved away with the Second Vatican Council from a model of return.
This would be the idea that other Christian churches simply need to return to Rome.
We moved to a model of dialogue. The Second Vatican Council's formulation for relations with other Christian churches and ecclesial communities was a shift towards describing our relationship as real but incomplete or imperfect communion. We are in real communion already by virtue of a common baptism, by virtue of a common faith in Trinitarian and Christological foundations. And the Holy Spirit urges us through the course of dialogue to deepen and flesh out that unity. I think the most significant effort to come up with a common date for Easter was a World Council of Churches meeting called the Aleppo Agreement. The idea was not to be choosing one calendar or another, but to use astronomical evidence.
This was in 1997, And it's an idea that all the ecumenists we spoke to for this episode still think is a good one. So what happened to it?
No one followed up. No one really reviewed. No one really studied. No one really cared. The next year, in fact, here in America, there was a good initiative taken by the theological dialogue between the Orthodox churches and the Roman Catholic Church, the national one here in America. And they came out with a statement endorsing the statement of Aleppo. And they too said, let's study it. My name is John Chrysafgas. I'm a deacon of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America, an archdeacon of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, working closely with the Ecumenical Patriarch, mostly on environmental, but also on other ecumenical issues. I know from the Orthodox perspective, at least, the Orthodox Theological Society of America came out with a statement saying we encourage our bishops to study these documents and to study this question for the diaspora. Again, this was back way before the year 2000, and nothing has happened ever since.
Father Chrysafgas has worked closely with Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew for the last 30 years. He also runs an ecumenical institute in Boston at Holy Cross Greek Orthodox Seminary. And he's seen the way that Orthodox Catholic dialogue on a common date for Easter has changed over the decades.
Possiamo vivere l'anniversario del Concilio di Nicea anche come un ricordo.
I have met Pope Francis on several occasions. I've been privileged to meet him. Both the Patriarch and the Pope have often become controversial figures because they've wanted to set aside some of the things that should matter less in our churches and bring to the forefront of our attention things that should matter in our churches. And people who are used to doing things in a particular way or who see truth in a particular way are uncomfortable with their initiatives and their vision. And the truth is, for me, if people are uncomfortable, it could be because the Pope and the Patriarch are actually saying something that does matter. And the question of Easter is one issue that both of them have grappled with and believe that it's not a matter of doctrine, it's not a matter of ethos, it's not a matter of canon law, it's a matter of tradition with a small t that can be changed, that can be at least reviewed and reconsidered. If we keep going on this particular trend that we have, 2,698 will be the last time East and West will celebrate Easter together if we don't change our method.
There's an end date.
There's an end date. It's the last day.
Oh, gosh. Father Chrysafgas explained to me that there are basically three ways a common date for Easter could come about.
One is we both acknowledge we're wrong and we say let's set a fixed date for Easter.
So, for example, celebrating on April 17th every year.
That might be more difficult in terms of betraying the norms of the First Council of Nicaea that sets certain standards. The first two options, the main options, are one, that the Roman Catholic Church align its date of Easter with that of the Orthodox Church. And that would certainly solve problems for the Orthodox, who would love to say, we knew we had it right. But the problem is they don't have it right. They might speak and like to talk about having the true faith. They don't have the right calendar, that's for sure. The right calculations they do not have, astronomically at least. It's not accurate as it's worked out in the Orthodox Church, both in the Julian and the Gregorian calendar.
Do the Catholics have the right date astronomically?
So I think Catholics are much closer to the date. So there are times in the next, say, 100 years when both the Orthodox and the Catholics will be right. And those years are normally years that we celebrate together.
Ah, okay.
I think there's one year in the next 100 years when the Catholics will actually be wrong and the Orthodox will be right. But that's one in 100 years. All the other times the Orthodox are wrong and the Catholics are mostly right. So there is some sort of inconsistency in both calculations. And for me, by the way, that is what might lead to an answer. If both churches can recognize that, perhaps both churches can appoint, commission a special group of theologians and scientists who can work on how we should be calculating Easter together. And maybe that will be a solution for the Orthodox and the Catholics. I don't know that that's easy, but it's certainly easier than deciding immediately right now, this is the date we want.
Here's how Father Chrysappius describes the other two, the more plausible options for finding a common date.
So one is for the Catholics to align themselves with the Orthodox Easter. It would seem to me that there are some people in Vatican circles, probably with the leadership of the Pope, even that would go that far for the sake of trying to maintain a more united status among the churches, because they recognize, both the Patriarch and the Pope, that a united Christian voice is more audible, more credible than a divided Christian voice, especially in our time. So that's one option. The other is that the Orthodox Church aligns its date of Easter with the Roman Catholic Church. I don't think that's going to happen, and not because it would be wrong, but because I think many Orthodox churches, and predominantly those who are less a part of the ecumenical movement towards, you know, understanding one another and trying to be reconciled with one another, they would never accept it.
No one we talked to would say which Orthodox churches would be unlikely to engage in this dialogue. But given the intra-Orthodox tensions between Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill and Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, specifically their disagreements over the Russia-Ukraine war, it seems that the Russian Orthodox Church would likely stick with the old calendar. In some ways, it seems like the easiest option would just be for Catholics to switch to the Orthodox calculation for Easter, even if it is less accurate astronomically. But that would create new ecumenical challenges.
There's no guarantee that all Protestants would come to the same decision at all. I'm Sandra Beardsall. I'm an ordained minister in the United Church of Canada. I live in Saskatoon, Canada, and I have taught ecumenical theology, and I've served in a variety of capacities ecumenically, locally, nationally, and internationally. I currently serve on the Faith and Order Commission of the World Council of Churches.
That's the commission that came up with the Aleppo Agreement in the 90s, and that still works on the common date of Easter question today.
So for Protestants, there are authorities, but they tend to be a little more dispersed. And of course, churches tend to be nationally constituted. There are very few examples of Protestants that would have any kind of authority beyond a national church, which is why it's important that places like the World Council of Churches, where there is significant Catholic representation, as well as Protestant and Orthodox representation, are good places for that dialogue to happen, because then churches can go back, including the Protestant churches, can go back to their homes and say, this is what we've decided collectively. Can we see our church living with that?
For Reverend Beardsall, there's a powerful parallel between that model and the model of the Council of Nicaea, where bishops from different local churches came together, made decisions, and then went home and said, this is what we discerned together. But not all Protestants feel that way about the World Council of Churches.
There's hesitation in some circles, and mainly in evangelical Protestant churches, towards the World Council of Churches. There's a sense amongst some evangelical churches that the World Council of Churches is trying to be a super church to tell them what to do.
Oh.
I should say, though, that things are changing. And I think as churches everywhere find themselves struggling in difficult economic and social and political situations, they see more and more the importance of churches everywhere finding common ground and being seen to be, in a very divided world, places where people come together around their divisions and find ways peaceably and thoughtfully to work on them.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the churches of the Middle East would really like to find a common date for Easter because they need to have a common kind of sense of their belonging in a very difficult situation.
Mm.
Generally, Protestants are hopeful that we can celebrate together. Unfortunately, I'm not sure they're as committed as the Catholics are. Catholics have a Catholic understanding of Christianity that says this really should be all together. And I personally would follow that trend of thought too. I think one of the challenges with saying, well, we'll go do it the way the Orthodox do, is that the Julian calendar is becoming increasingly out of sync with astronomy. I think the progress probably needs to be towards everybody accepting similar astronomical and geographical choices for how we make the decision about the date of Easter.
What Reverend Beardsall just mentioned is, once again, the Aleppo principle. Let's take the Council of Nicaea's method of calculating Easter, the Sunday after the full moon following the spring equinox, and work with scientists to make sure we're calculating the equinox and the full moon correctly. But some Orthodox churches would likely still be against that. I asked Reverend Beardsall why.
The best we understand is that some Orthodox churches, not all of them, but some of them, feeling a kind of pressure or resistance from their people and in global contexts where Orthodox churches exist in places where there is animosity with other countries in the world. They are reluctant to press their people to make a shift that looks like it's giving in to the West. Please don't quote that as something I heard directly from the Orthodox, but something that I have discerned from listening to the Orthodox wrestle with this. In many ways, this is an inner Orthodox challenge, kind of between that need to maintain their dignity as a church in a fraught world, and their need to be responsive to their own people who live in the diaspora, who want to be part of a global community and not just a national church.
The diaspora, that is, the many Eastern Orthodox Christians who live in the West, who face a tension between their church's own traditional Easter date and celebrating at the same time as the Christians around them.
So, for example, there are 10 million Coptic Christians in Egypt, but there are also at least 2 million Coptic Christians in other parts of the world, and specifically in the United States and Canada and Australia and places where Easter is celebrated according to the Western tradition. They would love to see Easter coincide with their culture because it often relates to holidays, to time off, to people and their families being able to celebrate with others in their own jurisdiction. There are other places in the world where there's a lot of intermarriage between Orthodox and non-Orthodox Christians. For example, the Christians of Finland a long time ago determined that they would all celebrate Easter using the Western calendar because they wanted to have coherence as a national group of Christians. And so there are lots of complicated things to discuss, and the churches need, especially some of the churches of the East, need time to try to address that with their own people.
Father Krusavgis, who works with the Ecumenical Patriarch, was part of a dialogue in January this year that called for an educational period about how the date of Easter is determined and why it might need to be adjusted in the Orthodox churches.
Our appeal is mostly for study, that this matter be opened up for honest study so that we can avoid misinformation, misinterpretation, misconception, discriminations, even hostility. Just education is a very important part of this. It won't happen overnight. I don't think either the Pope or the Patriarch could pull off just a decision on their own, because they're taking with them entire churches, communions, cultures, and societies and countries and so forth. And here in the diaspora that you ask about, I think the matter is even more meaningful and vital, because where in Russia you can say most of our people, almost all, are Russian Orthodox, we don't have to change our date. Even in Greece, there are 10, 12 million people in Greece. The greater majority are Greek Orthodox, very few Roman Catholics, even fewer evangelicals or Jews or Muslims and so forth. They don't really have to worry as much, although they're beginning to face it, especially with the forced migration out of the Middle East. They're beginning to see changes in their populations. But here in America, we wake up in the morning and we're not next to other Orthodox Christians. We're not, you know, next to even Christians all the time.
I mean, you say wake up in the morning next to, literally, there are so many mixed marriages between Orthodox and Catholics in this country.
Exactly. The mixed marriages are, I think, a crucial guide in our decision over something like Easter. And again, the Roman Catholic and Orthodox dialogue here in America has brought attention to what they call ecumenical families, for want of a better term. They used to be called mixed families.
That's a much better term. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So if we really care about people on the day of Easter, because people can celebrate Christmas together, a Roman Catholic father and an Orthodox mother and the children who may or may not be baptized in one or the other church. And the truth is, we still fight territorially. You know, we still wonder who's going to baptize the children. Should it be in our church? Should it be in yours? How much do we recognize of what happens in yours? How much do you recognize of what happens in ours? And I have to admit that Roman Catholics and Anglicans are much more open in terms of accepting other churches in their own either sacraments or services than the Orthodox are. So the question is, if we can celebrate Christmas together for these families, what does it mean for them on Easter Day when the children need to go to either two services or ignore one service? What do they do this year when it's a joint Easter? Do they go to one church or the other? But what is it that we actually do for them? If we accept their marriages, how do we show that we accept their marriages? One way of doing it could be this common Easter.
So there are several possibilities for reaching a common Easter date. There's the idea of a fixed date, which would fully depart from Nicaea's calculation. There's the possibility of everyone using the Catholic date, which would make things easier for Orthodox in the diaspora, but would face resistance from national churches that don't want to be seen as capitulating to the West. Then there's the idea that Catholics could shift to the Orthodox date, which would be less accurate and might not be accepted by Protestants. And finally, there's this Aleppo idea, where everyone admits that they're a little bit wrong in their calculations, and we all apply Nicaea's calculation to more accurate astronomy. That proposal would require the most change in dates for the Orthodox, which is why Reverend Beardsall and Father Chrysapis say that a period of education to get the Orthodox on board is an important next step. Here's Archbishop Bolin again.
I think there's a real hesitation to move forward with a new model when it will just create a new division, and that there are other churches that will simply not say, we agree with this, and then we won't really have moved forward to a place where all Christians are celebrating Easter at the same time. And there are churches that would be reluctant to make a change because the Roman Catholic Church was moving in that direction. There are churches that would be reluctant to make a change because the World Council of Churches was moving in that direction. Christianity is marked by some pretty deep divisions. At the same time, we have made so much progress in dialogue over the past 60 years, which has really changed the landscape of relations between Christian communities so profoundly. And many evangelical churches, Pentecostal churches that were once quite resistant to the Catholic Church or to the World Council are now in dialogue. So it's a little bit of an ache in the heart that I think Pope Francis feels, and many of us feel, that there hasn't yet been a way for the leaders of Christian churches to come together in some kind of forum where they can speak collectively to peace, to care for the planet, for our environment, where they could speak to justice issues, where they could speak to the common good. I think we long for that day. Are we on the cusp of some kind of agreement about the common date of Easter? I don't know. But I know that we're asked to do whatever we can to make it happen without compromise. But flexibility is different than compromise. We're not compromising our celebration of Easter by adjusting to a different calendar measurement. There's no creedal dimension to the Gregorian calendar. There's a creedal dimension to the death and resurrection of Christ.
Pope Francis and Patriarch Bartholomew want to do whatever they can to promote the fundamental unity that Christians share around the resurrection of Christ. To that end, they're hoping to visit İznik, Turkey, the site of the ancient city of Nicaea, in late May. That depends deeply on Pope Francis' health, of course. Father Chrysavgis explained that the Patriarchate in Constantinople, or modern-day Istanbul, wants to make it as easy as possible for the Pope to visit.
The Pope's heart is there. The Pope's heart is already on its way to Nicaea. And I know that at the Patriarchate, they're very concerned. The Patriarch's very anxious about the Pope's health because he's worked and been very close to him for many, many years now. And if the Pope can't be there, whether there'll be a similar event with representatives from the Pope, it still will be a powerful scene. But that is the big hope, that the Pope will be there personally.
Reverend Beardsall is hopeful that that event could include Protestant representatives as well.
I hear some Protestants saying, is there any chance we could be invited to this party too? But if we're not invited, I won't be deeply disappointed, because I do think that relationship between the Pope and the Ecumenical Patriarch is deep, significant, profound. We Protestants don't have the kind of global role models like that that the Orthodox and the Catholics have. And so that's a significant statement, whether or not Protestants are there. If we get to be there, if some of our representatives are there, I think it would enrich that experience at Nicaea.
No matter who's at Nicaea in May, there will be many celebrations of the Council's anniversary this year. While we were preparing this episode, the Vatican's International Theological Commission released a document commemorating the 1700th anniversary of the opening of the Council of Nicaea and announced that it would host a study day on May 20th, around the time of the possible papal visit. And in October, the World Council of Churches will host an ecumenical gathering in Egypt, asking how the Christian churches can show visible unity today. These questions aren't just about a date on the calendar. As our guests from Protestant, Orthodox, and Catholic traditions all told us, unity doesn't mean uniformity. It means holding our differences in dialogue, with honesty and care. That's something the Council of Nicaea embodied in its own way, bringing together bishops from across the Christian world to confront serious disagreement, and ultimately to find common ground. And that kind of encounter, rooted in shared faith, open to debate yet striving for unity, is something the church is still trying to live out today. Efforts towards a common Easter won't resolve the deep theological and ecclesial divisions between churches, but they do remind us that unity is possible, even around something as symbolic and as meaningful as our celebration of the resurrection. And in a divided world where fragmentation often feels like the rule, even a small step towards communion can speak volumes. So maybe the most important thing Nicaea offers us today isn't just a creed or a calendar, but a challenge. To come together across our differences, to listen, to discern, and to seek again what the church first declared at Nicaea, that Christ is fully human, fully divine, and that somehow, miraculously, that divinity is still present in the messy work of being one. Inside the Vatican is a production of America Media. This deep dive episode was produced by Ricardo da Silva. Production assistance from Maggie Van Dorn and Grace Lenahan. Audio engineering and sound design by Adam Buckmuller. Our executive producer is Sebastian Gomes. Special thanks to Ben Hellman and Claire Cohen. To keep up with the latest news out of the Vatican, you can follow me on X and Instagram at Colleen Dulley. That's C-O-L-L-E-E-N-D-U-L-L-E. And you can follow my usual co-host, veteran Vatican correspondent Gerard O'Connell, on X at Jerry O. Rome. That's G-E-R-R-Y-O-R-O-M-E. Producing a deep dive episode like this takes a lot of time and resources. If you'd like to support episodes like this one, please consider purchasing a digital subscription to America Media at americamagazine.org/subscribe or at the link in our show notes. And if you enjoyed this episode, maybe you learned something new, please share it with a friend to spread the word. For America Media, I'm Colleen Dulley. We'll be back in your podcast feed after Easter.
Hi, listeners. It's Ashley McKinless.
And Zach Davis.
From the Jesuitical Podcast. This is truly a historic moment. With the death of Pope Francis, we're publishing stories on his life and legacy, analyzing the state of the church, and looking ahead to the next pontificate. And we're here to accompany you every step of the way.
We'll be on the ground in Rome offering in-depth coverage on our website, americamagazine.org, our new mobile app, our email newsletters, and with bonus podcast episodes on Inside the Vatican and Jesuitical. So please subscribe to America to get all of our coverage by visiting americamagazine.org/subscribe. Thank you.